Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Hi, I'm Leonard Lopate, and welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. Since its creation in 1970, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has written and enforced a variety of laws designed to protect America's air, water, and land from the ill effects of pollution, development, and urbanization. And the EPA has achieved a great deal, from banning DDT to getting the lead out of gasoline to classifying secondhand smoke as a known cause of cancer. But while some have seen the agency as an effective organization that has inspired other countries to create their own environmental agencies, others criticize it for imposing too many regulations and at times of ignoring serious conditions. On today's show, we are going to take a broad look at why the EPA was created, what it has achieved, why it hasn't always lived up to its stated goals, and what its future role may hold. Joining me are George Pavlo, former Deputy Regional Administrator of EPA Region 2, which includes New York and New Jersey, and Robert Hargrove, former Director of the National Environmental Protection Act Compliance Division in EPA headquarters. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
The focus these days has been largely on Scott Pruitt and his policies, but the EPA already had a long and rocky history before he was even appointed to head the agency. So let's go back to the beginnings. 20 million Americans participated in the first Earth Day celebrations in April 1970, 48 years ago. Were there certain environmental problems that were already of concern at that time? Rachel Carson's Silent Spring had mobilized a lot of people. But she was dead by the time the law was enacted. How much environmental protection under the control of states and local entities in those days?
Okay, yeah. The issues back then were really, they weren't fully understood, number one. They were getting their understanding. Things like you mentioned Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Was very instrumental in getting people, in increasing people's awareness of the environmental problems or environmental issues that the country was facing. The problem was, at the time, was frankly there wasn't a great deal of statutory law. And it tended to be, and frankly still is, which is part of the problem, which is one of the problems, tends to be issue-specific. So rather than having like a comprehensive law addressing all environmental features or all environmental issues, we have a series of laws like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Research Conservation Recovery Act, and so on and so forth, all of which are targeted at specific issues or groups of issues. And that makes it very difficult for, number one, the agency to deal with these issues because quite often the issues cross, as you will, media boundaries.
And then different states had different ideas about what should be under control.
Well, yes, I mean that was one of the issues, but also the states didn't have at the time. I mean now they of course do because they followed EPA's lead, and also they responded to the federal laws. That basically required them, if you will, to establish programs. Now, again, I mean, we have 50 states and what, 8 territories, each of which may and often do have different approaches to how to deal with the environmental problems within their jurisdictional boundaries. The other main issue, which is why you need an EPA and a federal, approach to this, is because the issues very often do not confine themselves. Well, they rarely confine themselves to geographical boundaries. I mean, take air quality, for example. Air quality crosses all state boundaries. Then you take air quality and you expand it into expand it into an issue like climate change. And not only does it not confine itself to state boundaries, it doesn't confine itself to country boundaries either.
Now, George, let me ask George this. Why did President Nixon sign the Environmental Protection Agency into law? Did he have an interest in the environment, or was he responding to public pressure?
I think it was mostly the latter, that, you know, as a matter of fact, he was hesitating in the beginning in accepting the creation of an environmental agency responsible for environmental protection. But the rise in environmental awareness and the public pressure, and as you mentioned, the 20 million people who showed up on, you know, Earth Day in April of 1970, kind of forced his hand. And, you know, he tasked a commission to help him determine whether or not an environmental agency, you know, the so-called Ash Commission, you know, was, whether or not an environmental protection agency was needed. And, of course, the overwhelming recommendation was, yes, you know, we need one to essentially put all environmental regulations and responsibilities and accountability in one agency rather than having a mishmash of federal agencies, you know, where they had some responsibility, but they were not really implementing regulations in any way, like in the Department of Agriculture, in the Department of the Interior, in, you know, health, education, and welfare departments at the time. So they suggested to him to create it, and he accepted that recommendation.
He appointed William Ruckelshaus as the first administrator of the EPA.
Administrator of EPA, yes.
Was he responsible for laying?
Ruckelshaus was, you know, he had impeccable, you know, credentials at the time. You know, he was the undersecretary for, you know, civil affairs in, you know, the Justice, you know, Department as well. And, you know, he appointed, you know, after, you know, of course, the Senate and the House conducted their hearings, he appointed, you know, Ruckelshaus as the first, you know, administrator. But going back to what, you know, Bob was saying and you were alluding to, you know, who was regulating the environment before then, you know, you had 50 states with not a lot of expertise or a lot of resources or the knowledge that we have right now to regulate their own industry. And it was not really very successful because pollution knows no state boundaries. So air pollution in the Midwest would come to New York and New Jersey and New England. You know, water pollution in Long Island, you know, will travel all over the place. It's a big ocean or in the lakes or in the streams.
Well, the Mississippi River covers the whole country.
Yeah, so you needed an agency that was, you know, responsible for setting minimum standards to make environmental protection and regulation, you know, effective. And also somebody that the states can rely on, not only to provide the resources, but also the expertise in terms of how they go about regulating certain chemicals, certain pollutants. You know, going to EPA essentially as a mediator in case he had these intrastate or interstate, you know, controversies, you know, surfacing.
Bob, was Ruckelshaus... Was Ruckelshaus responsible for laying the foundation for the EPA? What were some of his major accomplishments?
Yeah, I don't believe Ruckelshaus was responsible for laying the foundation. He was given what he was given. What he did, though, is he organized the thing, it organized the agency and gave it a, you know, an actual standing among the other governmental agencies.
But didn't he overrule a judge's decision and issue a ban on DDT?
That's not my area of expertise. Uh-huh. I really don't know.
Bob, when did you start working at the EPA? Did you work under a number of different administrations?
Oh, I did, yeah. I mean, I started with Carter in 1979, and I worked, I guess, midway through the Obama administration. I was there for 33 years.
Wow. And you, George?
Well, I started working for EPA in November of 1973.
Wow.
It was towards the end of the Nixon administration and the beginning of the Ford administration, I would say. And then, you know, I worked for, you know, Republicans as well as Democrats and the various administrators of EPA.
I've heard there was a great deal of excitement and sense of purpose among employees in the early days of the agency.
Yes. Can I
yes.
speak first?
Yeah, go ahead, George.
Yeah. I mean, in the early days of working for EPA, you know, there was a sense of commitment, a sense of urgency that we were there to be dedicated towards doing something good, not only for the environment, but also for public health. I mean, we didn't have a lot of rules, regulations, you know, policies at the time. We used a lot of, you know, professional, you know, judgment in the way we would be issuing permits. As a matter of fact, the first week that I was hired, I was told, well, you know, this Saturday you're supposed to come in and issue permits. And my reaction was, really, I don't really have any experience in this. You know, I have a degree in chemical engineering. I do understand chemicals and how you control them and how you may treat them, but I have no experience in writing permits. And they said, no, you're going to come in. We're going to issue proposed permits, and then you're going to have plenty of time to prepare during the public comment period on how ultimately you're going to issue those permits. But all the people who were at, you know, who were at the agency at the time, you know, were a lot of, you know, engineers, a lot of scientists, a lot of environmental specialists. We were all working as one. It was almost having the cumulative knowledge of everybody working for that permit, you know, to make it functional, you know, and being able to issue it such that it contained some good limits. I mean, there were cases where we really didn't know much. You know, I remember I had a permit for a paper industry, and the only thing that I was given was some manuals describing, you know, the SIC code, the standard industrial classification of that industry, and I noticed that PCBs was a chemical concern. So I was asking around, well, what should the limit for PCBs be? And not too many people knew. And somebody said one part per million, and I said, man, you know, that sounds kind of low, you know, one part per million, 1 milligram per liter. But as it turned out, of course, that was quite high, you know, given that it was PCBs and what we know now. So given the uncertainty, we just said, okay, you're going to be monitoring this for 3 months, and we're going to determine, you know, a reasonable limit and what kind of technology you use to abate it, you know, later on, because by July 1st, 1977, they were supposed to have, you know, the best practicable technology to meet the limits.
My guess,
there was a lot of excitement, a good sense of camaraderie and teamwork, and the fact that we were all working for the same cause. And believe it or not, even though the industry was, you know, at times opposing EPA's actions, a whole lot of them wanted to work with you, you know, especially at the lower levels that we were negotiating in terms of what the permit conditions would be. And they were actually signing on, and, you know, it was an extension of the fact that they were also learning as we were going along. So the 70s was a period for EPA to issue rules, regulations, permit limits, statutory, I mean, help create, you know, legislation that was needed, but we were all working together as one team.
My guests on today's Leonard Lopate at Large are George Pavlou, former Deputy Regional Administrator of EPA Region 2, and Robert Hargrove, former Director of the National Environmental Protection Act Compliance Division in EPA headquarters. I'm Leonard Lopate. Bob, what is the National Environmental Policy Act, better known as NEPA? Is it under the jurisdiction of the EPA or a different entity?
The agency that basically oversees the implementation of the National Environmental Policy Act is the Council on Environmental Quality. They're located within the Executive Office of the President. Under NEPA, or which is the acronym for it, basically all agencies, so every agency, every executive branch agency, has a role in the NEPA process. The role predominantly is to use the NEPA process to evaluate the environmental effects of their actions. Prior to NEPA, basically federal decisions on say highways or dams or what have you, no matter what the federal action was, and of course there are myriad in any given year, thousands, even, you know, hundreds of thousands of federal actions in any given year, the decisions were predominantly based on, prior to NEPA, they were done based on cost effectiveness. And what was happening was, well, the environment was losing. In response to the number of federal actions that were going on. And again, you have to couple that also with federal with state and local actions, which are not directly subject to NEPA.
What's considered a major federal action?
Virtually anything. A major federal action is one of the highest level in the NEPA process, though, that requires an environmental impact statement. There are two other tiers below that. There's a finding of no significant impact, an environmental assessment, and then there's what's called a categorical exclusion. So there are three tiers which were developed through the federal government's application of NEPA in the first, say, 10 years of its implementation. So there is a number of studies that are done through the NEPA process, and there's been a number of criticisms over the years, some of them founded, most of them unfounded.
You were director of NEPA compliance in Washington for many years. What are some of NEPA's success stories, and what were the problems?
Well, the problems are, in my opinion, having worked with it for 35 years, in my opinion, the problems are perceived. I don't know is that they're real. I never experienced that they were real. What people do, though, what the public tends to do, is blame NEPA for other reasons that projects are delayed or stopped. And it's very rare indeed, that any project is absolutely stopped through the NEPA process. Many are modified to improve their environmental quality and make them more environmentally sound.
Could you give an example?
Sure. There's the Passaic River Flood Control Project in New Jersey. It was a tunnel proposed. It was never built, but it was a tunnel that was proposed, and the original proposal included the destruction or the loss of close to 1,000 acres of wetlands in critical areas. Now, wetlands are aquatic resources that are basically regulated and given protection under the Clean Water Act. And it was a flood control project, which meant it was in very close proximity to a number of these wetlands. And it was a fairly large project. The tunnel was, 40 feet in diameter, and I believe it ran about 23 miles. So it required a great deal of impact. And the initial proposal by the Corps of Engineers was to have no mitigation for those 1,000 acres of wetlands loss. As a result of our involvement with the project, we worked very closely with the Corps, and in fact, that loss of wetlands was ultimately mitigated. There are a number of projects that basically those type of things have happened on. There are some very big and some rather small. But mitigation is a vital component of the NEPA process. It's used to reduce, and it should be used to reduce the adverse effects of actions, so that they are, in fact, more environmentally sound.
George?
Yes.
In 1981, President Reagan appointed Ann Gorsuch to be your boss as the head of the EPA. Isn't she the mother of the Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch?
Yes.
She cut
well,
the... You, go ahead.
The only thing I would say is that there were probably... some of the worst, I would say years, but she only lasted for 22 months as the agency, administrator. As a matter of fact, I still have a T-shirt, that says I survived the acid rain Queens, the acid rain Queens, rain, of it, because she believed in what they call new federalism. It sounds like cooperative, federalism that Administrator, Pruitt, is espousing right now. But, she believed that, the government and EPA, we're too big, that, we should be delegating the functions, to the individual states, that EPA was over-regulating business, and that, the agency was essentially too big.
Well, she cut the EPA's budget by 22%, reduced the number of cases filed against polluters, relaxed the Clean Air Act regulations, and facilitated the spraying of restricted-use pesticides. Was it her goal to reverse most of the basic policies of the agency?
Yes. I mean, she did all of these things, and it sounds like, we are kind of approaching that same area as well with the president administration. But to give you a little anecdote, the morale of the people at the agency because of these actions, was very, very low. I remember her, you know, coming to the region to speak to the region because, you know, there is kind of a ritual that if you have a new administrator, you know, eventually they have to visit, and hopefully within the first year, all 10 regional, you know, offices. And I remember her coming to Region 2, and I was sitting in the front row. And essentially, she began the speech by saying that, well, in the last 10 years, you guys did a phenomenal job, an outstanding job. And as a matter of fact, you know, because you did such an excellent job, we don't really need you anymore. You know, you should be looking forward to, you know, new careers and new jobs. And I and you should have seen the reaction of the entire, you know, EPA Region 2 staff. I said, I can't believe she's saying these things, you know, to us. But that was her first message and my first impression of Ann Gorsuch.
And what had led the House of Representatives to cite her for contempt of Congress? She was the first cabinet-level official to be faced with that charge.
It had to do with the Superfund, you know, legislation whereby, you know, her assistant administrator, you know, as well as, I guess, the leadership of EPA at the time, they were refusing to provide documents to Congress that there was mismanagement and favoritism regarding the management of the Superfund program at EPA. And she invoked executive, you know, privilege not to provide the, you know, the documentation, even though in retrospect they were saying, well, that decision was, you know, the White House's decision, not her decision. But to make the long story short, you know, Congress essentially, you know, cited her for, you know, for contempt, and she was forced to resign, you know, her, you know, her position under, you know, pressure, I guess, to do so. But the fact that she had an assistant administrator, you know, Rita Lavelle, and at the time I believe I was in the program that she managed, the, you know, the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, as they called it then, she also, you know, lied under oath to Congress about, you know, the meetings, you know, that she had with the private industry, and specifically her previous employer. And whether or not they were liable as a, what we call a potentially responsible party for, you know, some of the waste that they were sending to one of the Superfund sites out in California as well.
Why was Ruckelshaus brought back after she resigned in 1983? Did he succeed in restoring morale?
Of EPA was at stake, and a lot of and it was a highly controversial period for EPA because of the actions of, you know, of the senior management of EPA to, you know, relax regulations, relax the enforcement standards. You know, kind of politicize the Superfund, you know, money in a way that, you know, made the agency look, you know, a little corrupt. So Reagan had no other option but to bring back a person of impeccable integrity, you know, Bill Ruckelshaus, who was respected by everybody. And I remember, you know, he had the all staff, you know, meeting with everybody, and he said, whatever we do from now on, think that you're in a fishbowl. Think that everybody can see what you do, what you eat, what you think, what you, you know, essentially where you are, and that's how I want you to behave from now on. Be transparent, and we have a mission, and our mission is to protect human health and the environment, and this is my charge to you.
Now, Bob, you mentioned Long Island Sound earlier. Didn't swimmers in the Long Island Sound routinely find themselves surrounded by bits of used toilet paper?
Yeah, they did.
So people couldn't swim, fish, or drink in the waters outside of Long Island, but also in many American lakes and rivers.
Yes.
The under the Clean Water Act, the U.S. invested tens of billions of federal dollars in municipal sewage treatment plants, but that was a federal thing. The states were not involved. The reason I ask is I'm wondering about Flint, Michigan. That problem, as I understand, was caused by state policies, not federal policies. Was the EPA involved in any way?
Well, yes. The EPA had an oversight role of what the state was supposed to be doing. and they were getting, as I understand it, they were getting the reports, but they weren't doing much with them. Again, they perceived it as, to some extent, it goes back to the individual laws, and in this case, it was the Safe Drinking Water Act. There are laws like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act that initially give a great deal of authority to EPA. But that authority over time gets delegated or assumed or authorized to the states, and then the states are supposed to be running the programs, you know, with some oversight and funding from EPA, but predominantly on their own. A law like the Safe Drinking Water Act, though, I mean, most of that law was written initially for state implementation. Now, there is oversight and funding from the federal government, but to a large degree, that law is implemented at the state level. As you mentioned, the toilet paper issue, that's really a solid waste issue. And again, the solid waste program was established at the federal level, was established through the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. But the solid waste components of that, as opposed to the hazardous waste components, were always a state responsibility. It was frankly never, even though it was the federal program was established through the federal law, it was really a law, a component of that law that was supposed to be implemented from the get-go at the state level.
How did the EPA go about cleaning up water?
Well, to a large degree, it was done through the funding of wastewater treatment facilities. You mentioned it before. It was, you know, funding level of about, you know, $2 to $3 billion on an annual basis to basically build and improve, either improve existing or to build new wastewater treatment facilities. That ultimately, then, that for all intents and purposes. Plus the implementation of the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES permits, which were for discharges into the United States, addressed then the industrial side of things. Between the components, those two components, basically the point source issues in the country, for all intents and purposes, were addressed. The issue now in the Clean Water Act, or now for clean water, is really a non-point source control issue, which, again, goes back to the states. That's a program that from the get-go, again, is within the responsibility of the states to implement.
We have to take a little break here. My guests are Bob Hargrove, former director of the National Environmental Protection Act Compliance Division, and George Pavlou, former deputy regional administrator of EPA Region 2, which includes New York and New Jersey. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is Leonard Lopate at Large, and we will be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Leonard Lopate at Large, we are a listener-supported radio station, not-for-profit, 501c3, the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio, with the Robin Hood Radio Network. And if you like this program, we'd appreciate by showing support for Leonard by making a donation. You can make a donation a couple of different ways. Go to robinhoodradio.com, click on Make a Donation, and make a donation that way. Or on our on-demand page, go to Leonard Lopate at Large. The donate button is right on Leonard's on-demand page on the on-demand section at robinhoodradio.com. And we thank you in advance.
We're back with Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate, and my guests talking about the history of the EPA are Bob Hargrove, former director of the National Environmental Protection Act Compliance Division and EPA headquarters, and George Pavlou, former deputy regional administrator of EPA Region 2, which includes New York and New Jersey. George, how bad was air quality before 1970? Was it mainly an urban problem?
It was as bad as you can, you know, imagine in terms of, you know, the quality, in terms of, you know, how safe the air was to breathe.
Cities like Los Angeles had real problems.
Yeah, it was, essentially covered in a perpetual, somebody called it, you know, cloud of particulate matter, you know, of little dust, you know, particles, you know, the air. And it meant that, the cities were often, choked by this, pollutant that was emanating from the smokestacks, from factories, from automobiles, which, Los Angeles is known for. And that was one, I guess, of the first priorities of EPA, not only under the Clean Water Act, to do something about, as you mentioned, the wastewater treatment systems and reduce pollution by a minimum of, 85% of suspended solids and biological demand, as they call it, but also to begin reducing the pollutants, in the air as well. And
so wasn't a major update made to the Clean Air Act in 1990 to allow the EPA to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions from power plants?
Yes.
Cause of acid rain.
And it took actually a tremendous political, strength from, George H.W. Bush, as well as the administrator at the time, Bill Riley, to pass that piece of legislation because, they found a lot of resistance from the automobile industry. And one of the President Bush, campaigned for it because acid rain at the time was devastating our rivers, our lakes, because all the air emissions that, we're getting from so-called stationary sources of, sulfur dioxide would be mixing with the water vapors in the atmosphere and come down as acid, meaning, it was acidifying the lakes and the rivers and the fish would be dying. And they passed that piece of legislation. And as you know by now, it has been a tremendous, tremendous, success in terms of reducing nitrogen oxide and sulfur dioxide by at least, 65%. And it was done, despite, the fears and the concerns of the industry that essentially, electric, rates are going to go high, and we're going to have power shortages and all kinds of, alarmist type of theories that they espoused at the time, but nothing like that, happened. As a matter of fact, air quality improved. Acid rain, you don't hear about it anymore, from people complaining about acid or some of the lakes, in the Adirondacks, are dying as a result of it, or the forests, are dying as a result of it. Because of the tremendous success that program had, and the fact, people just take it for granted right now that, acid rain, was controlled, but it was not like that. If it wasn't for the Clean Air Amendments of 1990 that, Congress passed, at the insistence of, the EPA administrator as well as the president at the time, we wouldn't be where we are now. And as a matter of fact, climate change would be a lot worse off if it wasn't for them regulating these two chemicals.
Now, Bob, how did the EPA get automobile manufacturers to install catalytic converters in cars, Bob?
Well, by laws that and regulations.
Did they fight it?
Required. Well, of course they did, yeah.
And now, but it wound up reducing emissions of unburned hydrocarbons by 85%. Did the car manufacturers now think it was a good idea?
No. I'm sure they didn't think it was a good idea because it added cost to the vehicle and added a good deal of cost to the development of an effective catalytic converter so that they would work. I mean, they're quite expensive. They're quite expensive units. Sure, they fought it because of the cost factor.
Then why did the EPA refuse to allow... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that, there would predominantly was the cost factor, and then also they felt to a large degree, as they always do, that the regulations, the implementation point for the regulations was they didn't give enough time to comply with the programs. And that, you know, of course, led into, you know, complaints and ultimately lawsuits, I'm sure.
Why did the EPA refuse to allow California and 16 other states to raise fuel economy standards for new cars? California had to sue the EPA in 2007.
That's interesting. You're right.
I believe.
One at a time. George, first let Bob talk. Go ahead, Bob.
Who's speaking?
You first.
To a large degree, it was because those standards that the states were particularly California were intending to promulgate far exceeded the federal requirements, and it would have caused a mosaic then of compliance and also with the different standards in different states. Now the states can propose standards for both water quality and air quality that exceed the federal ones. But if they're too far in excess, it can affect the economy. It can affect, compliance across state lines and a number of other reasons, which is why I understand that the EPA opposed components of the state of California and other state standards.
George, you wanted to add something?
California probably is the only state in the union where sometimes even EPA has to follow their lead because they are that good and that, advanced, in terms of environmental protection. And at the time, of course, the automobile industry didn't want, 50 states issuing 50 different standards. And if California were to have their own way, they would have forced to have those more stringent requirements in their automobiles. But, California is a big, big market for the automobile industry. So they, I guess sometimes you apply pressure at the right political, positions, and you get some, reaction out of them. But eventually when, other states like New York, joined, California saying, yep, we're going to also require the same standards as California, I guess, and the change of administrations, then that's when EPA decided to, change, their policy a little. And also Massachusetts, sued EPA in 2007 for the EPA failure to regulate, greenhouse gases from automobiles. Believe it or not, even though it was a narrow victory, 5-4, the Supreme Court, ruled, I believe, it gave the authority of EPA to regulate, carbon dioxide and five other, greenhouse, gases from automobiles. And that started, the way for EPA to work with the Department of Transportation to increase, fuel efficiency in cars, the so-called, corporate average fuel efficiency, which under, Gina McCarthy, our previous administrator, and Bob Perciasepe, the deputy administrator, negotiated that corporate average fuel efficiency per car should be in the neighborhood of, 54, 55 miles to the gallon. But as this is another regulation that's being attacked, right now, and the automobile industry wants those standards, relaxed as well.
Well, while it's been costly to comply with EPA's air pollution rules, haven't there been estimates that the savings from health-related problems is far greater than the expenditure on clean air?
Yeah, I believe we used to, use a ratio of, for every dollar that they spend, you save $3 in medical, costs, from air pollution and automobiles in general.
So why hasn't that argument been more effective?
Well, but that's the thing. I mean, to tell you the truth, when EPA is acting, they're acting, using the provisions of the Clean Air Act that does not take into consideration cost when we come up with numbers, limits essentially, that would be allowable to present, an acceptable risk. But cost, is something that any responsible manager would tell you, you know, plays a role in the ultimate decision because, you know, you may not be able to achieve a health-based number on technologies that we have right now. So one can make the argument it's bad for your health, but at the same time, it may be cost prohibitive to put it, so you compromise a little.
My guess are drug.
We do that even in the cleanup of, you know, Superfund sites, you know, as well. We come up with a remedy. We know it may not be fully protective, and we call it an interim remedy until such time that, you know, we do have the technologies. We do have, I guess, you know, cost considerations under control such that we can, you know, come up with a decision that is fully protective and not cost prohibitive.
My guests on Leonard Lopate at Large today are George Pavlo, former Deputy Regional Administrator of EPA Region 2, New York and New Jersey, and Bob Hargrove, former Director of the National Environmental Protection Act Compliance Division in EPA headquarters. Let's talk about some of the things that that I find a bit disturbing about EPA over the years. What led the EPA to assure the public that the air in the World Trade Center area of Manhattan was safe after 9/11? Wasn't there a lot of pollutants, including asbestos, in the air? Bob?
Should I go first? Or?
Let Bob go first.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. My perspective on that was that there was a press release that was written, and the press release was absolutely and unequivocally correct. What it basically spoke to was that the air quality off of the debris pile at the World Trade Center, with a certain distance beyond that, was safe. The press release never spoke at all about what the quality of the air was on the mound, because the expectation was that anybody working on the mound would be wearing appropriate protective equipment. In reality, it was taken out of context, and that led into, you know, to some extent, people misunderstanding what EPA was saying and then mischaracterizing what EPA actually said.
Now, George, you mentioned the toxic waste and the Superfund program. Can you tell us a little of the logistics of evacuating the Love Canal area twice? that incident led to the Superfund program, which Congress passed in 1980. And you headed the Superfund division in New York and New Jersey for many years. Was the goal of Superfund to tax chemical and petroleum companies in order to create a cleanup trust fund?
Yes.
Has that worked?
The had expired in the late 90s, and whatever money was in the trust fund, you know, to help, you know, deal with situations where, you know, we have sites that needed to be cleaned up, but, you know, we couldn't find anybody responsible, because enforcement comes first when it comes to cleanup of sites, where, you know, you get the private sector to do the cleanup because they are responsible for their own mess, which is the American way. You know, you created the mess, you clean it up. And because of Love Canal in 1978, you know, there were other, you know, sites in the country, like I don't know if you heard of the Valley of the Drums in Kentucky, where they found like 17,000 abandoned, you know, drums having all kinds of chemicals in them. Eventually they found out that 11,000 of them, you know, were empty, you know, leading you to believe where did the liquids, you know, go that they were storing in the drums. Or you had sites like, you know, Times, you know, Beach in Missouri, where they sprayed the roads with dioxin-contaminated oils, you know, to help suppress, you know, dust. But, you know, with Love Canal, you know, President Carter, you know, declared that an imminent emergency, you know, requiring the people to move out of the canal, you know, or surrounding the canal, you know, at the time. And we, as EPA, we didn't have the authorities to, you know, relocate people. We had to rely on FEMA to do the relocation of the people. And at the time, you know, I was involved with, later on, I was involved with the habitability study to determine you know, along with the Department of Health of New York State, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, the Centers, you know, for Disease Control, to come up with a study that would determine whether or not the neighborhoods surrounding the canal, you know, would be habitable. And I was involved with that.
Well, aren't we seeing similar issues with the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn and also the cleanup of the Hudson River? There's been a lot of resistance from the people who are supposed to clean them up to actually do that job.
Yeah. The thing is, that's kind of interesting, and allow me half a minute to finish about Love Canal.
Okay.
That eventually, people were moved into another chemical dump, you know, in Forest Glen, you know, Niagara Falls, and we had to go there, and we didn't realize that some of the people that they moved originally in the late 70s from the canal, you know, they moved them to another superfund site. Now, in terms of the Hudson River, we had a tremendous opposition from the immediately affected communities, you know, up in Fort Edward, New York, because they believe that the cleanup of the river would cause, you know, more contamination and it would destroy their tourism, you know, industry. I guess EPA, you know, was not very highly thought of because, you know, companies, you know, villages like that and towns like that, you know, they rely on major employers for their own, economies and their own survival. So they were adamantly against this, but we knew that, and we did some papers and, you know, white papers that we presented to the communities indicating that the remediation of the river, the PCBs in the river, would actually allow them to grow exponentially and tourism would come back, you know, if the fish eventually would be, you know, fishable. And also the fact that, you know, the company was supposed to develop 100+ acres of an area where they would be treating the PCBs, but the standards that we imposed in terms of how they could use that facility, which was totally undeveloped, but GE, you know, brought, you know, water, electricity, sewers, rail, you know, into the area. So to us, you know, whenever the Hudson River PCB situation gets completed, that area would provide the perfect and the most advanced intermodal facility north of Albany for the for the town and the village up there, you know, to use.
I would imagine they,
you know, for some reason or another, the leadership of the town and the village believed the, you know, the company's position that we would harm the river by remediating it because we would cause all the PCBs in the river to be relocated and resuspended in the river and therefore repoison the river, whereas right now they are sitting where they are and they're going to biodegrade and then sedimentation from upstream is going to cover it up. But when we did the design, and I would imagine deep down GE, you know, was hoping that if they're going to find that the PCBs would have biodegraded, it was the total, you know, opposite.
Well,
we have
very little time left. I want to get Bob in on one more thing,
yeah.
Because Love Canal, people suffered from high rates of illness, birth defects, and miscarriages. The EPA has appears to have ignored numerous complaints over the years about the environmental impact that the plant that makes Georgia-Pacific paper products in Crossett, Arkansas, is a problem. The locals are not defending Georgia-Pacific. Is it because the plant's owners are the Koch brothers and have a lot of political clout, even during the Obama years?
Well, I would assume it is, but I mean, I have no direct knowledge of what the actual issues are there, or, you know, other than what I would read in the paper.
Well,
so I really can't give you any insights as to why, but I mean, you know, I can suspect that, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of political, you know, shenanigans going on.
And I'd imagine there are a lot of political shenanigans going on in many of the situations that EPA has to deal with.
Well, that's what I was going to say, yeah.
Leonard,
yeah.
Can I say something?
Yeah, just 30 seconds.
Of, you know, one company towns and a lot of small towns that have industry in them, they are, you know, to put it bluntly, they can be manipulated by an industry into believing that if EPA doesn't regulate them, that they're going to move out, you know, that they're going to relocate south, they're going to relocate to some other, you know, country as well. And this is what happened, and I'm not going to name the town. In another town in upstate New York where, you know, their drinking water supply was totally contaminated with trichloroethylene, and here we are trying to force the company to deal with the groundwater contamination, you know, provide them with, you know, clean, no, I was going to say clean, treated effluent water, you know, to remove the trichloroethylene from the drinking water down to acceptable levels.
And, George, we've run out of time.
Convinced them that... we're going to shut down the facility. And I kept explaining to them that the liability of the company is going to follow them wherever they go.
George, you know, I have to leave it there.
For,
unfortunately,
you know, exemption of liability if they shut down the facility.
We've run out of time. And my great thanks to George Pavlou and Bob Hargrove for being our guests today at this look at the history of the EPA. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. And you can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archived program site, robinhoodradio.com. Check us out on our Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page and on the web at leonardlopateatlarge.com. Next week, we will be speaking with Philip Lopate. He'll join us for the Under Red Book Club discussion of Ivan Turgenev's late masterpiece, Virgin Soil. My great thanks to our audio engineer, Carolyn Garnes, and to Deborah Freeman for her invaluable help in producing this week's show. And we will see you next week.